Not only that, but Blab's really good. I mean, I still remember the happy days of Blab.
Don't say it too loud, but it was better than Crowdcast.
It was better than anything. You know, the idea of just like literally live streaming and bringing people on, that was awesome. So who's it? It was you doing it. Katrina was doing it really early on. It was you and Katrina together, wasn't it?
So we'd originally been doing Google Hangouts.
Yeah.
Hello, everybody. Sorry. We'd originally been doing Google Hangouts. Did you know we were live, Hung?
I pushed the button. But I thought, let's finish off this conversation first, because it's a bit of history.
Well, people might be interested in what happened. So, you know, we did Google Hangouts, which were actually really, really cool. They were very much like Teams. We did them with Alan Whitford. So he did them with us. And he was who I looked to for my hosting skills. He brought everybody in. And he managed to remember where the conversation was going, which is going to be our challenge today. We've got four guests.
Yep, indeed. And by the way, a big shout out to Mr. Alan Whitford as well. What a great guy he was. And very sad to hear of his passing earlier this year. I have to say as well, you know, Alan was the first guy who really did sort of persuade me to get involved more in the community side, because I saw a talk that he gave way back when, and I was just a cynical agency guy at the time. So I heard his talk. It literally transformed career path, so you know, owe him a huge amount.
Yeah,
we
absolutely did.
Cool. Anyway, we're live, folks. Welcome everybody to Brain Food Live on Air. It's episode 114, bringing it to you every Friday non-stop. And we've got a super exciting show for you today. One, I think we're going to dive into a lot of practicalities, but also a lot of philosophy as well, because deep down, a lot of the things we're going to be talking about are down to the ethical sort of values that we're going to have to put together when we're thinking about implementing some of this technology. It's about ethics in AI, and we've got some amazing guests to bring on. John Sumner's coming on, Rob McCargill's coming on. I've managed to rope in Meg Butler, who's in the middle of a house move. She's dropping in to help us have a chat here as well. And Markelos is coming back as well. Hopefully, when he registers, we'll bring him back on. Anyway, it's going to be a great show, so look forward to having a chat with everybody here. Quick sound check, folks. Can you hear me okay? We're on Crowdcast. Just give me an indication that you can hear my sound okay. I'm using headphones again. No more of the wired Apple phones. So I want to make sure you can hear me okay there. We are live streaming we're doing LinkedIn Live, I think. So do let me know. I don't know, Louise. I mean, basically, I'm trying to do this on a crappy laptop, a single screen. You know what I mean? Somewhere Steve O'Donnell will not be happy with. But literally, I'm doing it on a mobile phone and my laptop. So I've got to just check whether everyone can hear me all right. So anyway, if you can hear me on LinkedIn, give me a thumbs up, give me a thumbs down, let me know. And we are on the Facebook group as well. So if you're on there and you can hear me okay, just give me some sign that you can hear me okay. Okay, at least Crowdcast is on. I think some people can hear us. Okay, that's fine. All right, cool. Let's get on with the topic, Louise. Let's get on with it, because we've got a super, you know, I think you're right. We need to just dive straight into this topic because it is so big. We don't really have time to do too much pussyfooting around, to be honest with you. In terms of this topic, you've spoken to a lot of recruitment vendors pitching AI, this, that, and the other. What are the vendors saying when it comes down to the ethical dimension of this? Have you sensed that the conversation has shifted in any way in terms of how recruitment vendors are talking about the AI component of their technology?
So a couple of years ago, I was helping JobGate run their conference, and that's Job Board Conference, and I had the most amazing speaker. She was from Cardiff University, and she was all about ethics in AI. And people weren't massively thinking about it. They were thinking, and this is a question I'm going to pose to our speakers, they were thinking, if we can do it, let's do it. And now I think that it's turned slightly to, yes, we can do these things, but should we do these things? In whose favour is it? And then taking into account things like bias and things like that. So, yes, I definitely think we've moved forward in it. The funny thing as well is that for a period in time, we were talking about AI and then correcting ourselves to talk about machine learning. And I notice you've called this entirely AI.
Well, there's all kind. I'd like to think that we've moved to a greater understanding of the terminology, even though we've always struggled with it. I think in our industry, we've always struggled in at least. Although there is like a more clear consensus really in the data science world, what AI really is. So I guess what I'm trying to say here is any kind of technology that you can sensibly say has some ability to learn from the information you give it. That I would say, so I've got a pretty permissive view of it. I'm not thinking of, you know, some sort of HAL 2000 figure, you know, literally interacting with you on a sentient basis. No, I'm talking about something that, you know, it can produce outputs that you didn't directly program based on the information that you've given it. So I think fairly permissive, which ultimately means there's lots of technology that we can say has some sort of AI in it, because we're trying to build better technology that isn't that can learn from the information. And we're going to try and explore how this conversation sits and where it lies. So let's, without further ado, bring on our guests and we'll see what they have to say on the matter. Slight change of format. Go on, Louise, you're about
to say something. Well, I was going to say, while you're bringing everybody on, I was just going to say that we can see the comments coming in. So it'd be nice if we could reference some of those when we get the opportunity. But I was going to say, with four speakers on screen, it might be quite tricky. So it's great to see the chat continuing whilst we're on screen too.
Yeah, and I actually realized that I might not be able to do this properly. You can tell me, Louise, can I get six people on screen on this plan? Yeah. I can.
Oh, well, I don't know what plan you're on. Let's find out.
I pay you money.
By the way,
Louise kind of works. Louise works for Crowdcast on the side, so basically, she should know how many people I can bring on at any one time. But I've actually never tried six people. So
yay!
This is exciting.
It's gonna work.
This is exciting. Can we get Meg on? Is Meg here? Anyway, let's introduce our guest firstly whilst we're here. Oh, Meg's there. Whoa, we've got six people. This is a record. How exciting. Okay, let's kick off with some intros. Markelos, you came on first, so quickly introduce yourself. Who are you, sir, and what it is you do?
I'm happy to do that. I'm the CEO of Brick. And in Brick, we do hiring, and we help companies hire better. We use just a dash of AI, but we've took us forever to figure out a meaningful way to do it. So we're for AI when it's done correctly.
Fantastic. And great to have you on here to represent vendor side, Markelos. Okay, let's go to Rob McCargo, who's always standing up, this guy. I wonder whether he's got some sort of medical problem. Great to see you there, Rob. And can you quickly introduce yourself, what it is you do, sir?
Yeah, thank you, Hung. And I was just looking back on my notes. It was 19 months ago I was last on the on this. I was wondering if I did so badly last time, you brought me back for a second go round. So thank you for the privilege and the honour of coming back. So thank you. So my name is Rob McCargo. I'm Director of AI at PwC in the UK. Quite a strong focus on sort of all things to do with the workforce. I'm also on the all-party parliamentary group on AI, trying to inform policy and national strategy, and also a visiting fellow at Cass Business School, looking at future of work issues.
This guy's CV's got better since the first time I known him. Once upon a time, you were just a recruiter, weren't you, Rob? Now it seems like you're a big deal, which is great. Great, there's hope for us all. Thank you for that, Rob. John, let's introduce you. Who are you and what is you do, sir?
I'm John Sumpter, and I run a little operation called HR Examiner. I have been building ethics advisory boards in HR departments and companies for about 3 years now, and have been paying attention to ethics and AI for about 6 or 7. I routinely travel the American and Asian conference shows, and so I'll be doing some more of that as things come up.
And great to see you, John. And you, can I just say, the first time I've seen you clean shaven as well. This is quite a remarkable change.
It's been 25 years since I had a chin, so it's new to me too.
It looks great. Great to see you here, John. And Meg, thank you so much for joining. I know you're in the middle of a house move, so thank you very much for stepping in and helping us with this chat. Meg, can you quickly introduce yourself? Who is what it is you do, sir? Girl. You know what I mean.
Perfect. I'm hoping you can hear me okay.
Yeah, sound perfect.
Okay, great. So hi, my name is Megan Marie Butler. I am, I call myself a researcher around AI and HR, really focusing in on my PhD. Right now in the final stages. I didn't know that going down that endeavor was one of those things where you would not only lose yourself, but also like not know what the world's about anymore. Great process though. And this year, really looking forward to doing more work and advocating a lot more for ethics and AI, especially around the HR space, because it's becoming a great conversation. People are starting to wake up to what's really going on, and really fantastic to see you have this topic on air here now today.
Let's start with you straight away on that, Meg, particularly with regards to where you think the state of the conversation is at the moment. How would you kind of characterize the conversation about AI within the recruiting industry?
That's a great question. I think the challenge is that there's a lot of focus right now really specific on AI, with a lack of, and kind of started off the conversation, a lack of really understanding of what the technology is doing. And not realizing that we already have a load of laws that already exist around employment, disability in the US, around fair trade, et cetera, that actually impact how we're using AI already. And when we see in the analytics scene, we're already seeing record fines coming out with like H&M in Nuremberg just this last year. So we already know that there's problems. We already know that laws exist, but we're pushing them further.
Can you just give us some illustration of that example, Meg? What happened with H&M?
It was not just the fact that they were collecting data, but inappropriate data and tying it to sales performance.
Yeah, I think I remember this one. Yep.
Yeah, and it was like there's a lot of layers to what was going on there. It was also how it was leaked. It was also how it was stored. There was a lot that added up to that fine. It wasn't just the simple act of what they were doing with the data.
That in itself is probably a decent starting point, like the data collection aspect of it, because without the data being collected, you can't implement, or you can't, the AI will not be able to do what you plan for it to do. So how do we make sure that we're collecting the information in a way that is compliant with the legal environment that we're in? And imagine, for instance, let's take it to European context first, where we have a fairly stringent sort of view, consent first. How can you collect data from someone with consent in a way that it is actually useful? One of the questions that I have wouldn't be, you know, as soon as you ask someone the consent, doesn't that alter their behavior a little bit? You know, if I say, hey, Rob, I'm going to record you now, suddenly that's going to sort of change how you might behave. Doesn't that then kind of deform the value of the data that I'm collecting? How do we do this? How do we think about it? Let's go to you, Rob, seeing as I've used you as the example here.
Yeah, that opens up a whole series of interesting insights around behavioural change, doesn't it? I mean, to reverse a few steps alongside this, I've seen this extraordinary debate happening in Crowdcast on the side here, and people like Lee piling in around this. You know, what are we actually talking about around this technology? Last time, Hong, you did like stories of the week. You've skipped straight past that. But my story of the week this week was, did you see that one that popped up about a Subway tuna sandwich? And they did like a DNA search, and they found no evidence of any tuna DNA in this. Exactly. I strongly suspect a lot of the tools that are badged as AI fall into the tuna DNA camp. And we have to be really clear about what we're talking around, the application, what sort of tools and what sort of data is required for that to start with. I would say, and Christoph makes a great point here, you know, we've got this burgeoning debate now happening in the European Commission about the fit for purpose appropriate regulation, because it's simply not there yet. And I would urge people to look at what the TUC is saying at the moment. They've had a fairly bold paper that came out about 2 months ago that looks at things like legal duty of employers to consult trades unions on the use of high risk and intrusive AI, legal right for workers to have human review of decisions by AI, and therefore an adaptation to GDPR to guard against discrimination. So I think there's a lot of kind of mechanistic work that he's doing before we're in a pretty safe place here. I won't I'll probably lead on John to talk about behavioral change of what happens with candidates when they go through the process, though it's not my domain.
That's, you know, you've mentioned a few things that I would say would be very alarming straight away for anybody building software. You know, when you start saying there's laws happening at national level and supranational level, proposals that say, you know, you need to generate all of these measures before you can implement technology. Isn't that going to really make it very difficult for anybody to sensibly deploy software that has a component of, forget AI, even data collection, and make it work? What are your thoughts on this, Markelos? Because you're a European company, but you sell to the US, you sell globally. How are you sort of encountering different regulatory environments? And is that informing your product roadmap in some way?
Very, very carefully. And there is a legal and a moral obligation against candidates and employers alike, right? So when we start, we think of what can we accumulate from the candidates that's relevant and how can we let them know what we're doing? When you were talking about the data, and there are two aspects. One is it legal what I'm doing? And second, how do I do it in a way that doesn't influence? And the legal part is what our lawyers do, and they look at GDPR and informed consent. And when we're not forcing people to make the choice and so on, it's not easy, but it's manageable. It's not a perfect place, but you know there is some legal precedence and there's a lot of work there, so you can do it. The other part about actually influencing the behavior of the candidate, it's a problem that you always have, right? When the candidate comes in and steps in for an interview, guess what? You're influencing their behavior. Luckily, there is a lot of research around that, and our IO psychologists always look at how can we change the way we interact with the candidates, the way that we talk to them, how can we remove a lot of the testing anxiety from what we're doing? There, unfortunately, there is no one thing that works fantastic, right? But we see this and we always do incremental changes and we test things and we try to make sure that we present candidates with an experience that's similar to what they get in a regular interview. It doesn't feel very mechanized, or so we think at least. And at the end of the day, can we give them something that's going to be an accurate reflection of what the recruiter would get? And it's still a psychometric assessment, right? We know what we're measuring. We know why it's valid. But we try to remove as much noise as we can from the processes.
So one of the ways in which we could increase trust from the candidates and therefore gain their consent is to get as close to familiarity, a familiar process that they might expect going into a recruiting flow. Is that right?
You want it to be familiar. What we've done for Brick is that instead of saying, hey, welcome, here are 100 questions for you to answer, we've created a scenario and it feels like a chatbot. It's not really, it's just a scenario that's running. So the different people come and they ask you questions. And we started building scenarios that are for specific parts of the businesses. So for example, we have this express version that is more for blue collar workers. And the scenario there is different than our office worker scenario. Why? Because we want people to feel comfortable. We realize that when we have a blue collar worker talking to a fictional CEO, they don't feel at ease. So we changed that scenario. And now for that segment, we're using a line manager because that's someone that they'd feel comfortable with talking. And you know, that's a great way for getting that information. And we always try to improve the candidate experience, both in its interactiveness and also with the fact that at the end of the whole process, we try to reward the user with results. You know how you go online and you do personality tests and things because you want to know more about yourselves? When you complete the process with Brick, you're going to go through that and it's going to tell you, hey, we think that you're such a personality. And these are some examples of occupations that would work great for you. And here's your big five, all kind of information that candidates find interesting. At the end of the day, we do this and we find that the candidate experience is awesome. More than 90% report a high satisfaction from the process. Now, you can't get everyone happy. Let's be clear about that. But getting the majority of people being content with the process is a big step because that's the first impact that they're going to get, the first impression from the company.
So there's some thanks, Markelos. Useful elements there. So establish familiarity, give payback to the candidate so that they're not feeling as if it's just an extractive experience. They can get some output back. This, I think, is very much about collecting information in an equitable way, a fair exchange of information, insight back as a return. Is that one of the ways in which we could ethically use AI in this case? We kind of create a better experience for the candidate, and then gives us a bit more room to maneuver. Thoughts on that, John, in particular? Like, is the experience the key thing?
Oh, I would stay away from that as a focus because we don't know what the core technology does just yet. Right? One of the things that's it looks to me like the way that human beings advance is through hubris And this is amazing. Using AI to recruit is like fishing with dynamite. I don't know if they do that in the UK, but over here, out in hillbilly land, people go out in boats and throw a chunk of dynamite in the water and collect all the fish. And it's a great way to fish, but it's kind of bad for the lake, you know, and it's kind of bad for the fish that you don't get. It's just, and because we don't understand the technology enough, it's kind of indiscriminate. You can't really tell what the biases are inside of a set of algorithms. If you've got machine learning, it's going to be learning. And you can't control what it's learning, and it's going to be making decisions about that. So I would rather the focus be on increasing understanding of accuracy, increasing understanding of the complexity of the biases that a tool accumulates over time and how you manage and prune that to keep it straight and aligned. When you have an AI installation, the biggest single problem is maintenance. It's not what it does out in the world. It's keeping it on track so that it continues to do what it does out in the world. There's an artifact in machine learning that people are just beginning to understand, which is that machine learning will find all of the correlations in a data set, and then it will assign weights to those correlations in the data set, whether or not you can name the correlation. And so it's possible, it's always possible that the AI is putting weight on variables that are very hard to see, that you can't control. And we're just learning now how to make that stuff visualized and bring it under control. But we're in the stage that we're in with AI is the stage that Daimler-Benz was in when they opened the garage, right? It's a motor, it's a platform, it's some wheels, and it's a stick. And a lot of people are doing this stuff. And it's not till you get going 30 miles an hour and get your eye put out by a bug that hits you because you don't have a windshield that you think, oh, windshield, right? And we're in that phase of the technology, which makes regulation very tricky. It's very, very tricky because we don't know what we're regulating.
It also seems to me that the buyer doesn't know the questions to ask. So if you think about this in the context of HR and recruiting, you know, we're being sold lots and lots of things and they're meant to be improving the process. And some of us might believe they're improving the process for the job seeker. Some of them might be believe that they're improving our hiring process. But as an HR buyer, I don't think we know the questions that we should be asking about how this technology works, how it's learning, how it's making certain there isn't bias in there. I mean, is that something you're looking at, Megan?
That's a great question. The problem is if we have a poor process, you can throw as much technology as you want at it, it's still a poor process. If you can have a tool that's helping you with psychometrics, which we're using without AI very successfully on levels of both appropriate and inappropriate, but if you then hand it off to humans where the decisions are still being made by us, it doesn't matter. It's still going to have an impact. And I think the concept of we're not handing the decisions of, or should not be handing the decisions of recruitment over to AI in the sense of we don't want to be recreating Little Britain and computer says, hire this person, don't hire this person. We still need to be taking an intelligent approach. But you are right, with the technology market, there's a lot on offer that if you start to dig into how the product's being developed, you can see the issues already there from problems with data sets, problems with algorithms, problems with understanding what's really happening in the HR space too. I find a lot of the products that I work with, they don't even really get HR. They think it's an easy problem to solve. So they just kind of jump in there and go, oh, we've got a really great idea. Here's some data, here's an algorithm. We can make learning recommendations, or we can make this type of recommendation. And you start to dig into it and you start to realize, well, the taxonomies they're using are not accurate. They're old or outdated, they're too new and they don't take into account such things as old skills. So all of a sudden we have ageism going on or new discrimination happening in products. But it's not just buyer beware, but a lot of the product developers as well like need to be HR savvy and really understand what's happening. So there's both sides, but it's difficult because it is a big market right now. It has grown exponentially. exponentially over the last few years. And you have some great products out there that are being overshadowed by a lot of products that are a little questionable.
Yeah, I mean, just to weigh in on that point, I mean, just because there's been a litany of woeful stories that hit the press around recruiting doesn't mean that AI is a fundamentally bad idea. But I think to John's point, you know, I agree with everything he said there. It's about timing. It's about cautious innovation. And it's not about unleashing this in one fell swoop without our eyes open. I mean, I think on the ethical debate as well about, is there an ethical debate to be had about not using it when it's ready? I think about issues around things like social mobility, around about some of the things surfaced on your LinkedIn post, Hung, that was a pretty lively debate as well around who was missing out on opportunity. I think about, you know, cognitive dissonance in graduate hiring. You know, I think on the last one I mentioned about our scale of graduate hiring, we hire 2,000 graduates every year, but we have 150,000 apply. There's literally teams of humans sitting in Belfast pressing no 148,000 times a year. I mean, that's going to lead to poor outcomes. So in scope is a way of coding this well, of governing it right, of considering these things around ethics, bias, interpretability, and putting the right people in the room at the start. And we can get there, but it's not a case of just pressing play and unleashing the power of this.
I have to agree with this. And when we started looking at AI, we wanted to look at things and said, what can people do poorly and how can we help them? And the first thing is what Luis said, you can't throw AI on a broken process. It's just going to remain equally or more broken. So if you say, I'm going to use AI to screen resumes, you know that screening resumes is broken. You're just going to have a more broken process. That was one thing. So we said, okay, where do we get a clean data set in hiring? And there is no such thing. I know of no single company in the world where I can say, these guys have always hired correctly. I'm going to take their data set and I'm going to use this for all the world to make them all like that. It doesn't exist. So we said, okay, that goes out of the way. We can't use that. We can't use benchmarking. Let's go back to our least biased data sets. And even those are not completely correct. But we went back and we looked at all the things that the organizational psychology tells us. And organizational psychology tells me that if I'm looking for a person who's going to be, I don't know, a product manager, he or she should be more like this, this, and that. In terms of psychometrics, this is what we measure. But you can think about the different dimensions. And we said, okay, we have all these literatures, and then we have the recruiting managers who will never be able to read all that literature and make all the right choices. And what they usually do is they go from a database, and the database is fine and dandy, but you probably have realized that job roles rarely mean the same thing. So you look for a project manager, and that could be a salesperson, it could be a project manager, it could be anything in between. So what we did instead with our implementation of AI, we said, okay, can we teach our AI to look at the job description and from what we know from organizational psychology, propose to a recruiter what they're looking for? And this is a way different, fundamentally different way of looking at it. We're letting the AI do the hard work for the recruiter. At the same time, it's not making a decision. It's making a proposal. And it's saying, hey, based on what you told me, here's what I think you're looking for. And that takes away a lot of the burden for the recruiter. But at the end of the day, we want the recruiter to be in control and be able to say, yeah, it's mostly okay. Or no, I think you missed it here and here. And as they learn more, they can use the AI to do their job better and faster. But at the same time, they're never out of control. And it's really important for us. It's never a black box. It's something that gives you a suggestion, and then you see how the suggestion works. The selection itself is super open. And you know, it's because I clicked this and this and that, and this is how things happen. And I can always look back at the result. A major issue that we had with other implementations of AI is the black boxedness of it. It's like you throw in data to the AI, and the AI says yay or nay, but you can't really ask the AI why. Why did you say yay? Why do you think that we shouldn't hire Hung? Maybe there's a good reason, but I'd like to know what that reason is. Once we introduce this intermediary step and we say, okay, the ideal candidate profile is now created with the help of the AI, but when I tell you that you shouldn't hire Hung, I'm going to tell you it's because of this, this, and this of the things that you requested, and Hung doesn't match for that. Or conversely, he's the best candidate because he's excelling in these areas. These are baby steps, right? And we think that our application of AI is small. It's super helpful for our customers, and that's the feedback that we're getting. At the same time, we feel that it's the most conscious application of it. We do it the right way. We leave people in control. We make it easier. And we hope we're not introducing any bias. And we, to close that loop, we're now spending a ton of effort measuring the result of what we're doing. So yes, we're doing all these things and we think they're great. Is what's coming through the funnel actually better than what it was before? And that's the other thing. We should always look at the result, the end result of what we're doing. Are we able to improve diversity? Are we able to improve inclusion with what we're doing or not? And, you know, we're working a lot on this, but the early data says that, yes, we're doing way better than the human process.
So very interesting number of ideas there, Markelos. One of the things I think you said was it's a matter of moving, retaining the human decision. So making sure the human being always is the person, yes, knowing a candidate, but having the AI produce recommendations, let's say, or produce recommendation is the right word, but they don't sort of say a yes, no. Is that actually, might that be one of the windshields then, John? You know, a repositioning of what the AI does. It just produces more data. It doesn't actually make a decision.
Oh, I think you probably have to spend some time thinking about what a decision is before you can make a statement like that. If I've got 200 applicants and the AI presents me with what it thinks are the top 10, if that's not a decision, I don't know what a decision is. And if it tells me that Hung is number one, if that's not a decision, I don't know what that's a leap. But it's a decision. And so imagine that you're a recruiter in a recruiting shop and you keep going to your boss saying, I disagree with the machine is wrong, and here's why. How many shots at that do you think you actually get? The person who constantly disagrees with the machine is not going to get listened to after a while. And it looks to me like two or three times of disagreeing with the machine, and you're sort of out of luck. So the idea that you have the freedom to disagree with a piece of technology that the company has invested in and your boss measures your work with is as deep a misunderstanding as the idea that you could make looking for work the candidate experience any better than the experience that you have when you go to a dentist to have a tooth removed. It's you can be more comfortable, certainly. But it's never a good experience because the power dynamics are always imbalanced. And when you talk about decision making inside of an organization, the power dynamics are always imbalanced.
That's a really interesting point. Like, how often does the human being actually veto the AI? I mean, it could well be you just roll with the recommendation every time, and it makes you feel better for the fact that, you know, you've almost like created more confidence. In other words, the AI is ultimately a confidence building machine, but it also frames the choice that you're going to make. So interesting. I'd be interested to know whether you've got any data on the veto rate, if you like, of the recommendations, Markel. So have you tracked that at all? Or
Here's the difference. And what John's saying is actually very correct. If we had an obscure recommendation saying that Hung is number one because of our AI recommendation, he'd probably be very right. What we're doing instead is that the AI is setting with me what I'm looking for. And then I can agree and disagree on what I'm looking for. But then Hung is going to be number one, not based on what the AI says, but he's going to be number one. And you know, you're always going to be on number one in my heart. But based on how well does he match the objective criteria that we've set.
So
and
okay,
we said that I'm looking for someone who's super confident, and Hung is. So that gives him extra points. If I have now 2,000 people, or we had recently, we hired a content writer, 2,500 candidates. There was no way we'd look over 2,500 resumes. But we said, these are the criteria. The AI helped us build the criteria. But then we went over that. And by the way, we do have an answer into how often we see how often our people change the AI. And we think that we don't think we measure and we see that 90% of the time, they do one at least change. And that's fine. 10%, they take it over as it is. 90% of the time, they'll go and change one setting. And it's only 10% of the time that they're going to change more than two settings. What this tells us is that we give them the ideal candidate profile. that's very close to what they're looking for, but they still have a say in it. And they say, yeah, you know what? Your AI is fantastic, but I still think that this should be different. And now what they have is something different. Now we have a blind screening mechanism that's based on psychometrics. We can have a different debate on if psychometrics are the end-all be-all, and we don't think that it should be the only data point in any decision, but it's a great way to blind screen. And from our 2,000 candidates, we looked at the top 20, we looked at the resumes, we judged them now for what they're bringing in terms of experience, of background, and so on, and we chose a couple of people that we interviewed. We did this in a couple of days. People who wouldn't have access to a system like ours, it would take them much, much longer, and I doubt that they'd have anywhere near the level of success that we've had in our hiring.
Well, that's, I think, a really interesting point also. So what you're saying, Markelos, is the AI, so the ideal target is not set by a machine. It's basically an interactive process with a human being feeding into the machine, saying, I'm looking for this, and then the machine simply more efficiently brings that to play. I think
totally,
when it comes down to...
Sorry, conversely, you'd expect a recruiter to understand 100 different roles and know exactly what's required for its role.
Right. And I think it's really important in the example of scale, because what Rob was mentioning before, you know, when you've got like a massive volume of people coming in, actually the recruiter interest in actually scrutinizing every applicant is going to degrade. You know, they'll simply get bored and they'll say, right, that there'll be an optimal stopping point where they decide no more candidates. And that's also not particularly fair for a bunch of people in the frame. So perhaps it's about where we deploy this technology. Like, is it easier to do ethically when there's large scale, for example?
Well, I think scale is one aspect of this, but I think the context is critical and the specific use case. And we've spoken exclusively about CV selection so far, resume processing, haven't we? We haven't spoken about the sort of the criticality of the use case. For example, AI can be used in a very benign way on the onboarding process, just kind of, you know, remove inefficiencies in that process. On the other end of the spectrum, there's been huge controversy around the use of facial recognition, measuring gestures, features, micro expressions. You know, that's deeply troubling looking on the sort of the cusp of phrenology. And it's something I know you've written about, John, in the past. I mean, it's not about one size fits all here. Some tools are okay to be a bit opaque because they're just doing a really basic job. Some are fundamentally higher risk in certain use case areas that we should really delve into very carefully, if at all.
That's right. Exactly what I wanted to bring up. Exactly that. Sorry, Hung.
Go ahead.
You know, when you use AI to supplement what you find in the sourcing time. So when you're looking at CVs and then you think about how you're going to use our AI to look at social profiles, because we were talking about getting informed consent, and there's some applications where you're not wanting to tell the individual how you're sourcing other information which you intend to use within the recruitment process. And I wanted to delve into that a little bit.
This is obviously a topic where there's going to, every single time, we're going to spider off into multiple paths we can go down. I want to touch a little bit on what Rob said first, though, which is this idea that there are different ways in which you could use AI, and there's some obvious benign implementations. So, for instance, scheduling efficiency. I don't think anybody would have a huge problem with some sort of intelligent bit of software to organize an optimal time for people to talk. That's just a basic efficiency. But it seems we have a greater problem when it's making judgment calls on human a fit for job, or making assessments on a human being. For instance, more specifically about this, the facial recognition side. Now, I will ask the question, like, why is that? Is that simply us, like our value system needing to catch up with the technology a little bit? Like, why are we disturbed by that? Because isn't it a case that a human being is going to make the same type of judgment anyway? If the outcome is still that the individual in question is going to encounter a prejudicial outcome, what difference does it make if it's a human being or a machine making that thing happen? Are we just squeamish? Oh,
holy crap. Are you kidding?
No.
So what we're going to do in Hung's world is institutionalize racism with machines, because that's the way it is. And screw everybody who's not like this wonderful panel of basically white people. No, I don't think you can get away with that, and I don't think that you can get away quickly with the idea that there are benign processes. I don't know that there are benign processes, and if you look at the notes here, Juliet says we're hearing feedback from diverse candidates who are choosing not to apply if AI is involved, and that's because most of the AI systems that are built are not built with complex, diverse teams of people making sure they account for all of the kinds of experiences that people might have. They're built by white people who say, our onboarding system is benign. And you know that onboarding systems aren't benign because of the people who get onboarded, a significant number of them don't make it, right? So they're not benign. These systems are not benign. Scheduling is not benign. And what we're doing by saying we can believe that some systems are benign, so it's safe, is we're just ignoring safety. And one of the things that I've been doing lately is substituting the word safety for ethics. And if you substitute the word safety for ethics, you get a clearer picture of what we're actually dealing with. These are human beings, and categorizing human beings has very, very essential downsides. It's the first step to dehumanization is categorizing human beings. And when you install technology that does that, you're institutionalizing dehumanizing behavior. And we should not be doing that.
All right, really important point. Recruitment arguably is an exercise of reductionism, right? In the sense that, you know, we're not able to process the entire human being. We don't have the time, let's face it. Therefore, we reduce the person to a bunch of skills or a set of years of experience, and we take a chance to say, you know what, we think based on that information, that person is going to be a decent candidate for the job. Now, is that fundamentally unethical to do? And is that really the problem that we have with AI, is that it does this more efficiently when inherently the problem is something to do with recruiting?
No, I feel, if I may.
Of course.
The problem with many AI implementations, like, you know, the ones that try to figure out your personality from your micro expressions, is that it hasn't yet. And 10 years from now, we may be having this discussion. It may be completely different because it's all going to be proven to work. And we have data that says that it can be done correctly, regardless of race, age, gender, sexual orientation, all these things. Today, that's not the case. It's a simple question of, do we know how to do it right? No, we can do it right in some instances with small samples, but no one has really exhaustively tested it. So it's like we have something that looks like a gun and we start shooting and sometimes it kills people, but most of the time it doesn't because we don't shoot at people. It will eventually kill people, you know. Looking at this analogy, you understand how we shouldn't be using things that we don't understand well. We have a huge body of science for recruiting. We have industrial organizational psychology. People have been looking at these issues for over 100 years. And yes, eventually we'll have to choose people and there's going to be discrimination because, remember, it's not discrimination as long as I'm choosing the person who's best for the role. So can I look at the indicators? Can I look at the things? And this is what recruiters do that are most relevant to that person being successful. If we're able to use any technology, psychometrics, potentially tiny pieces of AI that we understand and we can control that help us do these decisions better than people would do it and remove some of the bias that people are introducing into this, then that's all great. And by the way, remember, we do a change, we have to measure the effect that it's having. Is it more or less biased? People a lot of times forget to do that. We're spending a time of effort now trying to convince our candidates to answer our EEOC surveys. Why? Because we think it's important to show to our customers that, look, here's what your incoming funnel looked like. Here's what the funnel that survived looked like. So are we making a choice that is unbiased or are we being biased? We're answering this question for ourselves and we're sharing this information with our customers because they need to make better decisions. These are the kind of things that you can do. And, you know, you make recruiters work better. You make the candidate experience better. And at the end of the day, we're offering an equitable process, which is really important. And someone was making the comment that people avoid AI because it's not equitable. Yes, AI systems and most of what I've seen in AI, and you've seen systems that went out of the market recently, they were not equitable. we can't put a label on anything that's AI and say that it's all bad, right? It's very implementation dependent. And this is the challenge for HR practitioners. They're not AI experts. How are they supposed to choose the good system from the bad system? If you ask vendors, I'll tell you that my system is the best and we're the only ones using it responsibly. Who can help them navigate?
That's a really good point, Marcellus. And I want us to move the conversation to that sort of stage where, okay, so it's out there in the world. We can't put it back into the Pandora's box here. There's going to be lots of different types of tools available. What kind of things do HR practitioners, how can we get better at selecting the technology, using the technology, maintaining it to the ethical standards that I think we generally align to? Go to you with this one, Meg. Have you got any thoughts on how the HR folks, you know, can't be expected to be experts, right? Unless we are arguing that, you know what, in order to procure this technology, you have to first be some sort of specialist, which arguably we can make that case. But currently that is not the situation. How can we equip HR buyers and users to be, to make the right decisions when it comes to buying and using tech?
I think there's kind of two folds there, two questions. One is using. So risk-based management approach is probably one of the ideal approaches. We're starting to hear that more in conversations. So looking at how mapping out and understanding how we're making decisions, where the data is coming from, et cetera, so that when somebody does get questioned on why was the decision made the way it was made, you have documentation to understand how and why it was made. And then the other question that you had, oh my gosh, it escaped me, and that was the more interesting one. Oh, the other part of that. Making better decisions about buying. One of the things I do have to say is, if you had a choice to go see a doctor trained in 1950 that had access to medical technology today, would you trust them to use it? And we shouldn't. So why would we trust a recruiter trained 20 years ago to use technology that's coming out today? Obviously, there is a bit of a skills gap, a knowledge gap there that we do have to recognize, and organizations looking to invest in the technology need to recognize part of being able to use new technology, as well as making sure that staff are well aware and understanding. There's quite a body of research, particularly in the medical space. And it looked at how medical professionals were interacting with new technologies and AI coming into healthcare. And that's where it starts to get a bit scary, because you do have people who are using the information appropriately, but a lot of other cases where, in one particular one that we can share, it's a research piece, it was medical inventory. So in hospitals, you have your prescription medicine that's held on site. They basically had a system that was based on the inventory, what was available in that hospital at that time. And following around some of the nurses, they discovered that some of the nurses were using it as a diagnostic tool as to how much or what type of medicine they should be prescribing to patients. So if the user in the context, which Rob mentioned earlier, is so vital in this piece of, then we're talking about AI ethics. It's not just about what the technology is doing, but it's how we're using the technology. We can have a knife and we can give it to a surgeon. We can have a knife and we can give it to a serial killer. It's the same tool, but they're going to use it very fundamentally different. One, hopefully to save a life. The other one, probably to take a life. So when we're talking about the technology, there's a lot going on. So one, the recruiters do need to up their game. Marcellus has talked about that quite extensively. When you're dealing with a recruiter that's using new technology, how do they work with it so that they can use it in an ethical way? But then also on the buying side, there obviously has to be an upskilling and understanding of the context and use of the technology that we're using.
Right. So go ahead. Someone was going to say something.
Yeah, John, let me jump here. So I'm not sure that you can say you can't trust a doctor who was trained in the 1980s.
50s. Let's remember, that's when we weren't supposed to eat eggs and a lot of other things. Or maybe let's go 1700s, when we shouldn't wash our hands between patients.
Sure. But the thing that we're dealing with the technology is something that changes so fast that the hardest problem with trusting a vendor is that if they started 3 years ago, what we know today is so different than what we knew 3 years ago. The only way that they could stay current is by having a process by which they rapidly scrap invention as technology manifests itself, right? And so that same problem of aging wisdom in the practitioner applies at a much faster cycle to this technology, because we are learning this technology, which learning a technology used to take 100 years, and we're learning this one in about 15 or 20. And what happens when you learn technology, I was thinking about when I was a kid and I had to mow lawns, and we had these, in those days, a lawnmower was an aluminum casing. It, just like the car I was talking about earlier, it's got a motor, it's got a blade, it's got an aluminum casing, and there's a big hole where all the stuff flies out. And it was routine in my high school to talk with kids who lost a foot mowing the lawn because the things were super dangerous. The technology evolved, and today it's pretty hard to cut off your foot with a lawnmower. They have blades that stop when you intersect them, but it takes experimenting and losing feet sometimes inside of technology to get what's going on. And we have to have some fluidity in that, because you cannot switch vendors every time the technology gets better.
Yeah, just like you can't. Yeah, there's practical issues, isn't there? Like, you can totally imagine you bought a bit of software. That's a huge decision to make, depending on the size and scale of the use case, I guess. But it's not something that you can just casually dispose and to reuse. That's typically not how the cycle goes. Okay, let's go to you quickly, moving on, because we're running short on time. But Rob, give us some sort of way an internal recruiter, an external recruiter, some buyer of software can mitigate some of these problems. How would they actually get themselves in a position where they're comfortable with using this tech?
So there's a few things that build upon what we've just discussed there. And John's spoken about it. Marcellus has spoken about it. Let's take it out of recruitment for a minute. AI in some form is having profound impact on our lives already. Recruiters have to be aware of the decisions being made about them without them already around credit scoring, whether it's being issued a mortgage, healthcare decisions. It's already very much in terms of influence in our lives. So we can hold it back from recruiting, but eventually it's going to sort of happen. We have to do it in the right way. So for me, it's around curiosity. It's around interdisciplinarity. If you give my team, for example, we've got 45 people. The majority are data scientists and engineers and product people, but I've got ethicists, lawyers, comms experts, and domain specialists in things like HR. I would say that the vast majority of these dreadful use cases around HR and recruiting algorithms going rogue is when it's been this homogeneity, as John was saying, of people that look exactly the same with no broader worldview. So I think interdisciplinarity has a big way of going, and hardwiring it into the governance of what you're doing. I was looking at the comments, actually, and Lee's asking about, do we have to get all recruiters to have become PhD mathematicians? No, not at all. But you can be armed with some bloody good questions to hold vendors to account and make sure you've got the right comfort factor that they're doing the right things.
So basically what we're saying is we need to bring in more different types of skills within recruiting departments. You can't just be like a super specialist recruiter and full stop it. You actually need to have other skills. But to answer Lee's point, we do need to take a step in that direction, I guess. It's not a case you need to be a genius at reading data or understanding how this works, but you need to do more than we currently do. Seems to be the consensus. Marcellus, you're saying something?
Yeah. So here's, and again, a biased view is from what I see. Here's how we're trying to put our customers at ease. And there are two main things. The first one is they have a sense of the candidates that they're seeing, right? And what our customers are saying is that we're using this. It has a small part of AI. It's a big part of psychometrics. What we're getting out of this is that we're starting to talk to people who don't fit our regular patterns. So we're seeing a more diverse group of people that actually make it through the funnel. And the people that we're talking to, they don't seem to follow the same clear-cut patterns. So this is kind of, you know, you get your gut sense of how things are working. But we're going, and this is good because this is your first sense of how, you know, you're doing. The second part is we are doing with all our customers reviews, usually quarterly, where we're looking back at the data and we say, how did we do in terms of diversity? Did we get people who are more successful? Do we have more churn? What are the other metrics that we can implement? And this is really important, especially in terms of diversity. You're doing all these things and it may be all correct unto your knowledge. If you're driving the wrong effect, then you have to go and revise your process. And this is one of the harder things we do, where we always go back to our system and we say, people are looking at this information, they're drawing the wrong decision. So let's change it. Let's present it in a different way. It's all about how do I gather all this data? How do I process it? And how can I empower then the recruiter to make better decisions? And it's not easy, by the way. We haven't solved all the problems quite yet. But we're building on this and we're incrementally improving. And at the end of the funnel, we're measuring what comes out and we're seeing that we're going in the right direction. That's something that everybody should be doing. Am I hiring better? Am I doing the same things I was doing last year?
Okay, so I think that's a valuable thing to see, Markelos. The idea that you can't just buy off the shelf, plug it in, turn it on, and you know, deal with that. No, you have to constantly review the output. And you can imagine some of the very high profile cases. We talked about probably the Amazon case is one of the most obvious ones. If that mechanism, that human process, so it's not a technical process, it's a recruiting process that's been put in, that review process would have caught that issue earlier rather than have it expand into a chaotic environment. Okay, listen, let's go to questions because I think we've got 5 minutes left and we've got a bunch of questions we've got to go through. Let's dive into these ask question section. By the way, anybody on Crowdcast have a question, put it in the ask a question section, we'll get to them. Okay, so Flavius has said, what are the data points in your AI algorithm? Okay, I don't think we can answer that question sensibly. Let's move on from that. Okay, Maury's saying, can you address the higher view case? So can someone quickly remind me what the higher view case was? They're a video interviewing software. Weren't they? They were doing micro expressions, I believe. Is that the case?
Micro expressions, yeah. They were trying to determine personality based on that.
What do we think? Is that a bad idea? They pulled it, obviously.
Again, I don't know the details of the implementation. So what I'm going to say is going to be consisting mostly of, you know, very gross oversimplifications, but they haven't tested it with enough data and there is no proof that this even works. There's not even, remember, AI is awesome at taking something that works and replicating it. If science says that when you look up and to the right, you're always lying, AI can do this 1,000 times better than the human. But I don't believe, and I can be corrected here, there is no science, no clear-cut science with micro expressions. There's nothing that says 100% that when you look up and to the right, you're lying, or vice versa. So when you don't have a solid process to begin with, there is no algorithm, let's put it that way, then there's no way that the AI can figure out how to do this consistently. And it's going to take correlations, and based on your sample data, it's going to learn some things, not necessarily the things that it should.
Okay.
So if the process doesn't work, don't throw AI to it.
No, hang on. Let's float this a little bit further. Is it because it doesn't work that we shouldn't do it? Or is it something to do with the fact that they're analyzing your facial expression? What if it did work? What if, you know, your pupil size did determine whether you're any good at the job? Is it still something that's ethical to do?
Yes, with consent. I think if you can prove that it actually has some scientific basis and that you can say that it fits into the process and it actually will have a valid outcome for both parties and you get consent, then I think that that's probably acceptable. And I think that's what the concern is, isn't it? Is it scientifically valid? Do we have consent? Is it improving the process? And are we validating it? Are we going back, like you just said, Michaelis, and interrogating it? And not just letting it run.
Yep, cool. Good answer. Let's move on. With final question from Nicholas. If we shift focus to profile-based insights, i.e. showing personality type, would this help remove the issue of bias? So I think this is actually saying, I'm not sure what it's saying. It's saying getting rid of tenure, I guess, getting rid of CV, do a psychometric. This is basically your thing, Markelos. Is that going to remove bias if we get to understand the personality, or is that just another way in which bias might occur? Thoughts on this, John? No, Markelos, we'll go with John on this.
so to back up to the facial expression thing, one of the things that you get from people who peddle AI is the idea that 90% accuracy is somehow good, or in the States, We talk about it being non-biased if only 1 in 5 people are subject to bias, right? Because that's the government guideline. And here's where you get to the difference between morality, governance, and ethics. Ethics is the middle ground where you try to figure out what's right in this case. Governance is the law. You can do this and you can't do that. And morality is like the law in that you can do this and you can't do that. In ethics, the question is, what can you do right now? That's the best thing to do right now. And so we're not going to get to the place where you can do micro expressions until the AI is capable of understanding all of the cases where micro expressions are not possible, like Bell's palsy. I've had a couple of friends with Bell's palsy and their faces don't move. And so you run this terrible risk of discriminating against those people if you say that micro expressions are a determining factor. If you have your face broken out, or you have pink eye, or you have a cut, or you have all sorts of things on your face, there's not a good way yet to tell that those things aren't factored in. It's possible, but not likely, that we can solve this technically.
Yeah, okay, we get that. I think that's a very good point, John, particularly given the potential episodic expression or presentation you might have in a certain situation. For instance, if I have a big night out and you give me the higher view micro expressions, you know what, I might actually get the job, you know, who knows? So how you look, you know, and your body changes over time. We all know this. Okay, moving on quick, folks, because we've got to just hit these questions. Let's go with this one from Lee Candiotti. Lee saying, how much can an algorithm account for a recruiter's laziness, lack of integrity, or inability to effectively analyze the accuracy of the AI it's providing? So I'm not sure what Lee's saying there. He's saying that
there are some products actually being developed that look at the recruiter rather than looking at the candidate to see cool. how the recruiters are doing. But that is actually becoming more of a thing. That's actually kind of a great question.
Yep. By the way, that's called interview analytics, isn't it, Meg? There's lots of really interesting things that are happening where the AI is actually turned away from the candidate and actually going to the recruiter and saying, you know what, we can improve how the recruiter does his or her work and de-bias the human being using AI. I think that's a fascinating implementation, maybe something that is something we could roll with. Okay, Lee, sorry, I haven't answered the question there. There's one more from Rom. Can you repeat that question, Lou? I think you pulled it from Facebook or something.
Okay, I've got to find it now. Yeah, so that was right back up here. He says, AI can dramatically improve recruiter productivity, finding needles in haystacks. How are companies, especially within the EU, preparing for the European Commission legislating? Have you got any thoughts on this, Rob?
I mean, I think it's so recent, isn't it? I don't think they've had time to properly digest this yet. So I think they're going to be finding the way through this and seeing how far they can push the boundaries. But no, I think it's too recent to have a firm view, in my opinion.
And Meg, are you talking to people who are concerned by this?
With the EU regulations, it's a bit of a tough one right now, because in the EU regulations, they put kind of all HR tech. And I saw a comment go up about like all HR tech is like high risk. But Rob really quite clearly pointed out there's a lot of use cases, like when we have a chatbot that is doing nothing more than answering like very pre-programmed questions, like how, like that's not making a recruitment decision. It's just an assistant tool. So there is some issues around that. Then I kind of, I mentioned before, what we're hearing or what we're talking about in the kind of groups and the research groups is understanding like what products, like what are the types of AI, like what is it doing, the context, the use that need to be worried about, and then how do you manage that? There seems to be some cases where it may be like it just needs to be shut down. I think we're going to be seeing that in some areas in the next few years. But I mentioned it before, it seems to be the popular one is the risk-based management and documentation, which is actually required already. We do it, and I find it really quite interesting in the UK, in the research area, we do it extensively. But then when I go to a business and do almost an identical project, they're just like, we document it. They don't even seem to be aware of the regulations that already exist. And to know that like if there's a decision made in your recruitment and somebody feels they've been discriminated against right now, they can ask you for how was that decision made. And if you don't have that documented, that's a problem.
Yep.
So if you're throwing AI in there.
Just got to finish this because we're coming to the end of the show. Basically, what we're saying is that documentation is something you need to have. Therefore, the that the responsibility for that is actually the using company. So the company that is actually using the technology needs to have some way of documenting it, which obviously increases the admin load into what you're doing. Okay, John, very quickly, because we're going to finish the show in about 60 seconds, sir.
Okay, one quick thing. There are no innocuous cases. When you use chatbots that do not understand dialects, you prejudice the system. There are no innocuous cases yet. There's nothing about this technology that is proven to the point that you can say this implementation is risk-free. And so
This is something that Maury mentioned as well, actually, on the chat there, John, which is, you know, basically cultural variance, even how, you know, gender, potentially people vary with regards to how they communicate. Is this a solvable problem? Anyway, listen, we are coming to the end of the show. So thank you very much for your attention, folks. Obviously, this is we could do an entire series on this topic and not come to the end of it. So let me take the opportunity to thank our amazing panelists. Markelos, thank you very much for joining the show again. We'll be in touch soon, sir. Megan, thank you so much for interrupting your busy day. Good luck with the house move. John, great to see you. Thank you for your comments. And definitely we'll get you back on for the show for a return visit if you're up for it. And Rob, great to see you, sir. We'll have to not wait 19 months before the next time we bring you back. Okay, that's it, folks. Have a very good weekend. I'm hopefully going to try and document some of this, actually, and summarize it to help people kind of get a grip of this. I think it's a very important and interesting topic. We all need to upgrade our knowledge on it, I think, because the opportunity there, but so is the risk. Okay, have a good weekend, folks. Thank you very much for watching.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Have a great weekend.
Crikey, that was a great show, but way too short, wasn't it? There's so much more to say in this topic, and I'm not entirely sure. Probably the initial idea of kind of mapping out the ethical landscape, if that's a way I can describe it. I'm not sure I've achieved that because I'm no further ahead in terms of my thinking on the ethics of using AI. But let me compile this together and we'll figure it out. Anyway, if you've enjoyed the show, make sure you follow the channel. We'll be back next week. What are we talking about? Oh, we are talking about how do you do headcount planning for hypergrowth. It's going to be super interesting. We've got a load of companies that have raised a load of money. TA teams, what is the challenge? How do you actually go from hiring 100 people to hiring 2,000? What is the way in which you plan it? Make sure you follow the show, folks. See you next week.